As referees, we're obsessed with mistakes because it's what we're judged on. The moment you in any way look uncertain, players will start filling in that vacuum with their opinions. One of my colleagues, and was being filmed taking his children to school, you know, you don't need that when it's just your job, you know. That's a level of scrutiny that's too far. If you want to be liked, you're in the wrong job.
Hello everyone, welcome to More Than a Name, the podcast that explores the untold, unfiltered stories of sports figures. Max Whittle and Luke Young with you as always. Before we introduce our guest today, I wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who has supported the podcast so far. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you can, please leave a nice review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really does go a long way. Last but not least, we are at More Than a Name Pod on Instagram and TikTok, so follow along as we continue to grow. Now today, we are joined by former Premier League referee Graham Scott, a man with nearly 1,000 professional match appointments, including 470 as a referee, over 100 Premier League games, and more than 100 VAR duties. A former semi-professional goalkeeper himself, and now columnist for The Telegraph, Graham offers a rare blend of frontline refereeing experience and clear, honest analysis of the modern game. Graham Scott, welcome to More Than a Name.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I just want to get straight into the conversation that you and Luke have been having, because you've been talking a lot before we came into the studio. So what caught your attention from that little chat?
In many ways, how much we've got in common about the way we see the game. And there's often a false conflict between players and refs, and there's a kind of assumption that we're at odds with each other the whole time. And of course, on the field, sometimes that's true. But step away from that, and actually we share a lot of the same issues around pressure, about dealing with social media nowadays, about scrutiny we're all under, how we cope with injury, disappointment. It's been really interesting, isn't it? How we, you know, we just kind of immediately just start talking football. And we didn't disagree on much. We maybe in the next little bit, we will.
You're not on the pitch anymore, are you? Luke, what did you want to ask Graham as soon as you met him?
Well, we're on friendly terms at the minute. I'm sure at the end of this pod, we might not be. But I think it was a lot of the crossover between player and referee. You know, as a player, you're constantly getting scrutinised. And as a referee, I think it's even more so. You do get a lot of stick as a ref. I think you've got to accept that that comes with the job.
To a point, right?
On the field and from the stands, we kind of see that's part of the rough and tumble of the game on the whole. And actually, our relationship with players on the field is generally better than people realise. We're having lots of running conversations which are quite positive and constructive and explanatory, and we move on. Clearly, when a really big decision comes along that people don't like, it's gone against them, or maybe they actually think he is plainly wrong, that's when the real pressure comes. But I always used to find that I could manage with that, because I've got cards in my pocket. If someone's really behaving inappropriately, I can do something about it. It's my choice. What I found difficult, especially the longer my career went on with the way the scrutiny changed, was what happens off the field. So you have that moment next day when you, can you look at the newspaper? Can you open social media? Increasingly no, almost regardless of whether the game's gone well. And then you've got the thing where you step out of your house, am I going to be okay? Do I need to kind of cross the road of certain people coming towards me? Which didn't really happen to me, but I know it's happened to others. One of my colleagues, and was being filmed taking his children to school, you know, you don't need that when it's just your job, you know. That's a level of scrutiny that's too far. As you say, it does go with the territory, and I think once you reach that level, you kind of expect it and can accept a large part of it.
And referees can't hide. If you see behind Graham, we've got the brightest of orange shirts. And behind me, is that your first Premier League?
Yeah, so I kept that one. I don't keep much memorabilia, but I did keep the shirt for my first Premier League game, which was 11 years ago, almost to the day. It was the 29th of November, 2014. Burnley Aston Villa. Bit of a surprise to me to get the appointment. I knew I was kind of in the frame. But they'd been handing out one or two trial games. I was the fourth to be chosen that season. Don't think anyone's really talking about me, which is always the objective.
You asked Luke a really interesting question about whether he ever wanted to be a ref. So do you want to answer that one again, Luke?
Yeah, the easy answer is no, because listening to Graham and the scrutiny and the pressure that you have to be a ref. But I can understand why, if you perhaps get injured early in your career, or you know, you get let go as a youngster, that it could be a career path for players nowadays. And perhaps we will start seeing ex-players going into it.
Yeah, there is a pathway that's been opened up by a combination of the PGMO, who run professional refereeing in England, and the PFA. which has got about, I think it's about 15 to 20 ex-players on it, of varying ages and experience. Too early to say whether that's working. They've been going about 18 months, I think. But it'll be interesting to see whether there is a way that we can get ex-players from later in their careers into the professional game rather quicker. The standard career pathway for a ref is somewhere between 15 and 20 years from your first game to the Premier League. It took me 17. So if you, it's okay if you start at 14, that's not so bad. You're getting there at 31. But if you do what I did, which is to play first, retire at 27, take up reffing at 29, you're not going to get... I got there at 46. That's too old now to really have a proper career, although I had managed to carve one out by staying fit. But it's not really the ideal. You'd want people getting to the top level much younger. So if you're going to have a playing career first, which I think we agreed earlier was probably going to help you a bit. It's certainly not going to hinder you if you've played. If you've got the characteristics of a referee and you've played, that combination is potentially powerful. So it would be good to see more players maybe coming through.
And do we need more refs? Is there a lack of top referees?
There's a lack of top referees for others to judge, I think.
Yeah.
But obviously everyone thinks that. There is a lack of officials lower down the pyramid. There are games that are not covered. Most games, of course, just have a referee. They don't have assistants, which then you have forever having contentious offsides because it's the person with the flag is from one of the teams. So, you know, it's not great.
I heard you mention yourself that perhaps you felt that you was ready for the step up and spent a little bit too long, maybe down the leagues a little bit, and you felt like you was ready, but there was no opportunity.
I've been on both sides of that because I felt after 3 years on the Football League, I was ready. I'd done a big, reasonable, decent number of championship games, and they were now, I was delivering those. So where's my next challenge? The next season, I started poorly and that knocked me back. And it can then knock you back almost for 2 years because you need 2 years in a row where you do well. So you then need to build that back up. And then I got put into a development group. And then after 2 years in that, I got my chance. But that did feel like it took too long. A lot of that is lack of opportunity. Well, then you look at the other end of my career where I'm still on the Premier League in my 50s, when really by now I should have been moved on or stepped aside. But then, of course, no one had done that for me. So why would I do that? You know, and I didn't feel any obligation to do that.
Graham, you've previously said that if players pick up on any weakness of a referee, you're toast. How do you stay strong in the moment?
You need to, it's mainly through your body language. So my approach was whatever is going on this field, I am going to appear at least try to appear calm and in control. And I'm not going to look flustered. And I'm going to stay in the moment and I'm going to make the best decision I can, regardless of the context, whatever's being thrown at me. The moment you in any way look uncertain, players will start filling in that vacuum with their opinions. If you rush to judgment, there's a danger of making a mistake because you've not checked maybe with your assistant or filtered the information properly in your head. But if you take too long, players in both teams will now come in and then you look like you've been influenced and you look weak. So you've only given them a yellow card because they shouted at you sort of thing. So there is this kind of sweet spot you try and find, which is can be quite difficult.
If I knew the ref was making real strong decision, go away, I'm not interested, I'm not listening, that's great. So you know you're not going to be able to change his mind in any way. And for me as a player, that's easier to get on with. When people start getting around the ref and maybe he's second guessing himself, he can lose control of the game really quickly. So I always preferred the really firm, strong, commanding refs that, listen, he might have made the wrong decision, but he's made it now. He's sticking with it. Get on with the game.
I think we should show that clip to young refs because a lot of younger referees, or inexperienced referees, I should say, it's not about age, it's about their level of experience. They're trying to be liked and it's not a job where you're going to be liked. If you want to be liked, you're in the wrong job. So, you know, you need to understand that you are going to be unpopular, that whatever decision you give, even the most obvious, half the players are going to be unhappy about it for whatever reason. So just accept that. Be strong, as you say. I'm not sure about stern, but I'll take that. But certainly strong and assertive and confident. There were a couple of times in my career where I did change a decision because I could just tell in that moment I must have got that wrong.
Can you give us an example?
My first championship game, QPR Norwich, I don't think you were QPR at the time, but I was following a challenge, two players going into the penalty area, and I was in my head, I was telling the defender, do not try to tackle here, you cannot win the ball. And he then did tackle, and I thought, you're a fool, this is a penalty. Like a very confidently from a very good position, blow my whistle, point to the spot. Only then did I realise actually the ball's gone over there and the crowd are going, what's that for? So then I thought, okay, I cannot stick here and do what you said. I've made a mistake and I'm just going to be tough. No, this is insane. I can't do that. So I went, I just kept, this is before we had the radio set. So I went over to my assistant and I just said to him, that's not a penalty, is it? And he said, no. So, okay, I'll give a corner. And actually, it was quite interesting that it was the Norwich skipper, Gary Doherty.
Yeah, Doc, I know. Doc. Yeah. Ginger Pele.
Yes. That's not what I called him, but yes, he was the skipper. He came up from the back, he said, for the corner. He said, what's going on there? I said, okay, I knew straight away I got it wrong. It's a corner. And in fairness to him, he thought, okay, well, you've made your call now. And he was okay with it. So tried to send a player off for two yellow cards at Millwall. That's not a clever place to do it when it's a home player. When it was his first one. And again, put it right. Of course, you can't double down on something as significant as that anyway. So there are times when you've just got to hold your hands up.
Once you've pointed to the spot, are you allowed technically to change your mind?
Yeah, as long as the game hasn't restarted.
On that, do you think fans know the rules of the game? 100%?
No, and I don't expect them to. I think players should know them pretty well, or at least know what they don't know. I mean, I heard a podcast with Michael Antonio and Callum Wilson, both of whom on the field I had good relationships with as far as I was concerned. But Michael was complaining about foul throws in a recent game we were playing in. And he went, oh, no, they played four. They were none of them were all foul throws. I couldn't believe it. And then the conversation went on. They said, well, actually, I don't actually know what the rule is, but I'm sure that he's got to have his foot there. Is it? It's like they don't pretend you know something that you don't, you know, just accept that you don't know all of them. But I'm convinced there are players who know the rules of golf better than the laws of football, which I do think I do find that bizarre.
How many rules are there?
Laws of the game. I should know this, shouldn't I? 18.
Okay. Doesn't seem like a stretch to know all of those then.
No, it's not the thickest tome to read. What you find when you read them though is how much vagueness there is and how much is open to interpretation, which is why we have decisions that are so often disputed around, well, is that enough for a penalty? Well, it's not going to say in the book. It's what the game accepts and expects in those particular circumstances. And we get those all the time. Little foot-on-foot contact or upper body.
Does that let you ref, though, in your own style a little bit, if there is that a little bit of leeway for yourself to express how you want to ref?
There is, but then we get accused of inconsistency, of course. And then if we're really consistent around something, so during COVID, we became really consistent around foot-on-foot tackles in the penalty. If there was any contact at all, we gave a penalty. And the number of penalties rocketed. I mean, it went through the roof. And the game fed, the Premier League clubs fed back to us, this is making no sense. We can't have, that's not enough for a penalty. Fair enough. We agreed. We felt we got suckered into giving them by the fact there was no crowd and we could see and we can now hear the contact as well, which made a big difference. And the players learnt to squeal every time it happened, which was rather clever on their part. But so we then reined back. But then how much contact is too much? How do you tell on a foot-on-foot tackle, for example?
I've got an opinion on this because it's always been something that, you know, has been a bug of mine is, why are we looking for something called a penalty? So if it's in the penalty area, if it was on in the middle of the park and you give a foul, then it's a foul in the penalty area, then it's a penalty. Sometimes it's like, oh, that's not quite enough for that to be a penalty. Mm. Now, the way I see getting around that is to stop giving the lesser fouls, if you like, in the middle of the park and let the game flow a bit more. Yeah. So then is a consistency that if it's a foul, it's a penalty and you're not looking for something called a penalty.
Yeah, I agree that's the solution. And generally in the Premier League, more than any other league in the world, that's what happens. So we tend to give less of the kind of what you might call cheap free kicks. We still have a tendency, and I was guilty of this myself, of course, of when it's a defensive free kick in the final third, little foul, potential foul by the attacker, the defender falls on the ground, we find ourselves giving a free kick to the defending team because it feels like sometimes a bit too much of an easy way out and we should be stronger and not give those and accept that, you know, then the player won't fall over. But I agree with you in principle that we'd better try, in terms of consistency, try and give fewer cheap free kicks, if you like, let the game flow. And that is actually the main reason the Premier League's the most watched league in the world. It's because it flows. It's because it's fast flowing and the referees facilitate that. That's what we do.
I know it can be an incredibly harsh environment, but would you be able to give our audience an example of what you hear from players, from fans, from managers?
From fans and managers, precious little. So your patrol path on the field wouldn't take you close to the benches very often. And the crowd noise and the other things, other noises that you have, noises off, you can't really hear them. You can see some of the animated body language if you choose to look. Most of that looks confected to me. So I tend to dismiss it and not to take any notice of it. You can hear, obviously you can have conversations with players and you can hear what they're saying. But in the moment of a really big decision, you're usually focusing on listening to what your colleagues are saying or speaking yourself. So if you have a penalty decision, part of the process now with VAR is to tell the VAR what you've seen and why you've given the awarded the kick. So if players are shouting at you, you're not taking that in. You're really not. But I wore my earpiece in my right ear. My left ear's hearing is probably at about half, I don't know, 60% or so. I can't hear them anyway. So it was quite difficult for me to have a conversation with the player sometimes because this one's got a mold in it and the other one I can't hear very well from. So I'd have to get really close to them to have that conversation. So a lot of it, it looks worse than it is when you're in that moment because you're just so focused on the decision. You then gone bombarded with the same question repeatedly is what's happening? What are they checking it? Yes, they're checking it. You know, you should know that by now. It's been in 6 years. But I get that because the lack of information in the stadium is the biggest, my biggest bugbear with VAR is the fans in the stadium and indeed the players on the pitch don't know what's happening. And we don't. As refs, we don't know. We're waiting for the VAR to do their work. You see other sports, rugby, cricket, they put up on the big screen and everyone can now follow it and be part of the process and be participants in that process. They can see it and they can maybe understand the decision, accept that it's clearly right, or if they want to, they can boo and whistle, but at least they would be part of the process.
There's a current official that I did an event with last year and he was saying that for VAR now mic'd up and explaining the decisions in stadium, that happens in the NFL, we've seen it across different sports, but his issue was, if I'm a Mancunian at Anfield and I explain a decision that goes against Liverpool, how does it go down?
I did all the training for that, but then I never had to deliver one. And I'm glad I didn't have to, is all I can say, because for various reasons. American football, I think, is a very good model because they basically distill it down into very short factual statements. So they might say holding 24 offense, first down, and everyone knows everything that's gone on there from those few words. In football, we're trying to do a slightly more narrative approach. So we'll say this team's player number whatever initiated contact, therefore it's not a penalty kick and my final decision is this. And that, of course, leaves you wide open to, well, hang on, that's not quite the right word there because I've just seen these pictures that show something slightly different. And also you'll then have, we know it's like with social media now, that then becomes a clip and then that gets recycled every time something similar, even remotely similar, happens again. When I was in the group, I did advocate, could we not try something very, very punctuated, so holding number five, penalty kick. The argument against that is that the laws of football are quite nuanced, so it's not really always the case that you get a clear-cut offence that can be described in a particular way. You kind of, like you were saying, not enough. And I can't come out from away from the screen and go, well, I've seen there is some contact, but yeah, it's not quite enough for a penalty, so I'm going to give a drop ball to the goalkeeper. No one's going to go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, fair enough. In that, you know, it's just not going to work, is it? So it's a work in progress, probably introduced before the refs were quite ready, in my view. But
who makes the decisions?
That's a good question. It's in combination between the Premier League and the PGMOL. I guess ultimately it would be Howard Webb as the head of PGMOL. And it's part of that piece around engaging the fans more in the stadium because the biggest negative feedback they get is that supporters in the stadium are not, they're left in the cold for 2, 3, 5 minutes.
Are you glad you didn't play with VAR, Luke?
I'd have to defend differently. I think in my day, you had to rely on the linesman to make the correct decision. So if a forward made a run, you would tend to go with it unless it was a very silly run where you could step up and it was very clear that he was going to be given offside. If a player made a good run, you would generally have to go with it, which meant you would probably start dropping a little bit deeper as a defender. Nowadays, I think if I was a defender, I'd take a little bit more of a chance thinking, well, even if he scores, I believe he was offside because I've took that chance and it will go to VAR and he'll be, you know, given offside and I'll get away with that. So I would have defended in a different way. I think from a fan's point of view, the worst one is obviously when a goal goes in So they don't, even a player, you don't actually know whether you should be celebrating yet, and it's a big anticlimax when it's either given or it's not given.
One of the things about being VAR that people, until you've done it, I guess it, no one will ever quite get it, but you've seen this challenge during the build-up to a goal and a player's gone down and you think, that could be a foul, I need to go back and check that. So the ball ends up in the, if they score, the ball ends up in the back of the net. So, okay, well, let's go back to the start of the attacking phase of play, and that was the change of possession, so that would be that point. And the first thing you see in a 3-second loop is this foot landing on another foot. And you start seeing that a few times, and they show it again and again and again until they find a better angle or a different angle. Once you've seen that a few times, you can't get those images out of your head. And all of a sudden, instead of seeing it for what it was in context over a longer period, you're seeing this micro bit of football where one player has trodden on the foot of another. Well, in most contexts, when that happens, you end up with a free kick, don't you? But then there are many others when you don't. Was one of those.
Are you conscious of the time ticking away as well in the VAR booth, thinking, I need to make a decision because this is dragging on a little bit now as well?
Yeah, so there is a tendency. When we first had VAR, I asked my assistant, because we have an assistant referee sit next to us who follows live play when you're checking something while the game's still going on, because it can happen. And they have other duties too, around timekeeping and so on. And they help you with offsides. There's various things that they do. But I would say to them, if I've taken more than a certain amount of time, I've forgotten which limit I set, maybe a minute, I say, just make sure I know that. Because if I'm still pondering, the chances are it's not clear and obvious, we need to move on. That kind of works in a straightforward situation. But I've also had... I had a goal in a cup game a couple of seasons ago where the ball's crossed, it's flicked on, it's headed back across the goal by a player who might be offside towards another player who's onside but who may get a touch on the ball. And if he does get a touch on the ball, then the player who then receives the ball is offside. If he doesn't get a touch on the ball, he'll be onside from the original header. It then hits this player high on the arm and it drops to his feet and he scores, in which case you'd have to disallow the goal if it's handball. You cannot work through that in 30 seconds or even a minute. It took me forever. It's so exasperating because you know how much you're ruining this moment. They scored a goal in a cup tie late. I can't remember where it was in the second half. That may well push them through. It's the quarterfinals. They go to the semifinals, Coventry City. And you spend all this time. It took about 3.5 to 4 minutes from memory. And you end up saying to the referee, it's a goal. What was the point of all of that? You know, we've just ruined everyone's moment only to end up with the same decision we started with.
Yeah, but as long as it's the right decision.
It was the correct decision.
Are there too many camera angles?
No, if anything, we could do with more because we have blind spots. So one of the curiosities is that different games have different camera plans. So you this is public knowledge. You walk around a stadium, you can see where the cameras are. So you get a 3 o'clock Saturday, you'll have 15, 16 cameras probably. One or two of those might be being used for interviews, so they'll disappear at some point late in the second half because they need to be ready for the interviews and the press conference. You'll have other games, which are a big TV game. You might have 35 to 40 cameras. Cup final, you might have even more than that. You might have a game where you're doing 3 o'clock on a Saturday and there's only one camera behind one of the goals, so at the other end there isn't one. So now you've got a situation where you need to check something and you've got nothing really to go on. Of course, no one else has either because we've got access to every camera, but in some ways we could do with more information. For the offside decisions now, I don't know how many there are. It's three figures, the number of cameras around the stadium, so that the semi-automated offside technology can literally never misses anything. So if anything, you'd have VAR, you'd want almost more information rather than less.
I did want to ask you, I know it's slightly off-piste here, but the infamous incident with Richard Keys and Andy Gray talking incredibly rudely to Sean Masiellis. Are female officials less respected both in the industry and in the stadium?
I had met Sean because, by coincidence, I was the referee on her first Football League game at Hereford United. So this was quite a big moment for her, obviously. Of your first Football League line, you really remember. It's your first game of professional football. Mine was at Orient. I mean, certainly in the case of Sean, and until very recently, and probably still the case generally, women who make it in football are making it despite their gender, not because of it. They're still absolutely up against all the odds. Now, in the last 2 or 3 years, there has been some positive action taken to try and help address the lack of diversity in the refereeing pool. We went almost 15 seasons without any games in the Premier League refereed by anything other than a white man. That can't be right. There must be something systemic in there to for that to be the case. And action is now being taken, which I very much welcome. It's getting a right balance. At least now positive steps are being taken to address that.
Because I'm assuming this is an incredibly competitive industry. Could you take us into that world a little bit?
Yeah, so it's a curious job in a way, because we stick together and we're mates and we help each other. And we will, it's like any other working environment, you're in the same team and you want to, if one of us really makes a bad mistake, we all feel affected by it. In that sense, we're very supportive of each other. But at the same time, we're competing with each other for places. Now, you would have had this as a player where within your squad, take the goalkeepers as probably the best example. Mm. The goalkeepers stick together, they'll train together all week, they'll want each other to do well. But I don't believe you're sitting on the bench, you know, if the goalkeeper in the team makes a bit of a mistake, it might be your chance, mightn't it? That is still true. You want to win the game, but if they're not doing so well, you might get your chance. So it is a curious, sometimes there can be some conflict in that.
You mentioned before on another podcast that you never used to like watching mistakes back. Mm. I found that really interesting, because I think as a player, if you've made a mistake, you can say, right, listen, I should have got out there tighter, I was in the wrong position to start with. And I just wondered whether, is that because you're constantly getting criticised that you just want to move on as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I did look at my mistakes, but what I tried to avoid was something that was almost like, this is just calamitous, this is really bad, I don't need to carry these images around in my head. And I made a few, I mentioned the one at Millwall, I did watch that about once and I didn't watch it again. Mm. I'd done my learning. As referees, we're obsessed with mistakes because it's what we're judged on. And I sometimes kind of remind people, we never have the joyous moment. We don't win a cup, we don't win promotion, we don't get to do the open top bus tour. Well, not yet. I mean, I'm all for it if anyone wants to come along and see that. But we never have that kind of moment of winning promotion. It's the best it gets is to come off the pitch having not done anything wrong, to have not been noticed.
I was going to say that.
It's really weird, you know, to have that's your own objective, is to not be noticed.
They didn't
not make a mistake.
I had a good game because no one noticed me today. Yeah.
I mean, the biggest compliment I've ever had from anyone in football was they'd watched a TV game and they'd said, oh, yeah, I really enjoyed this game the other night. And I said, well, yeah, so did I. I was the ref. And they, were you? I didn't even notice. Brilliant. Yeah, that's what you want. But it's a really, you don't jump up and down on hearing that, do you? You just go, oh, that's nice. The nearest you get to that moment of joy is news of a promotion. You know, so you're dancing around your kitchen because you've got a letter or an email, but that's not quite the same, is it?
How quickly can you be demoted if you're not performing? Do you get that for the year, or if you make a couple of high profile errors, are you in danger of being demoted in the same season?
Yeah, it's happened with VARs who've made significant process errors. They're not even checked something they should have. They've gone. That plays to an interesting challenge around how we're held accountable. If you make a serious mistake, you won't referee the following week, almost as a matter of policy. If you do, it probably be at the division below, which is now a whole different set of processes. You've not got VAR, you've now got a different team working with you, who have also the people who've made mistakes from the previous week. So you're kind of all together in this kind of bubble. That accountability is interesting. But there's a danger if there's too much of it. It makes you fearful of the job, makes you afraid to make a mistake. Yeah. And then you're now not refereeing with confidence.
You also talk about the fact that you are judged from day one. You're always getting feedback. We've got these referee observers that I'd like you to talk about. But how does being an official bleed into your personal life as well?
We get obviously scrutinised by all sorts. I mean, everyone's scrutinising you, aren't they? And we get feedback from clubs, which is often quite useful, but also often just dictated by one decision in the game. So this referee's had a terrible match. Well, they haven't. They've made one decision that you didn't like or you thought was wrong. If Harry Kane scores a hat-trick and misses a sitter or misses a penalty, he still had a good game. You know, he still gets the man of the match. Depends on the levels. In the Football League, the lower divisions, they still have an observer who goes along and watches the referee and gives them a report, which produces a mark, which goes to three decimal places. So it's incredibly precise and detailed. In the Premier League, we have delegates that are sent by the competition. So they're ex-players, ex-managers who come along, and they're there to provide a more qualitative report around your relationship with the players, relationship, how you dealt with the team sheet exchange, how you dealt with the captains, the way you communicated. Then we have a match review with our coach, which is going through the whole match. You'd have a meeting with your team, and you'd go through lots of incidents. You'd go through some clips and discuss whether you could have done better here or there, discuss your communication, your positioning. And this goes on for 2 or 3 days. And then you have the key match incident panel that meets on a Wednesday that goes through all the big decisions from the weekend. Their feedback can be instructive. It can also be confusing because sometimes you're told you got it right and then the KMI panel comes back with a different version of events, with a different opinion. And you can feel a bit kind of bombarded to the point where it's not necessarily helpful anymore. It would be better to have one really good conversation. I would have preferred one really good conversation with a coach who had filtered all of that information for me, and then we could have maybe had something more constructive. But it does, you ask about how it bleeds into your personal life. It did, I think it was more the issue for me was around not being picked. I live in a relatively small town and I'm not well known, but I know quite a lot of people there because I've lived there my whole life. I played local sport. So I'd run in every day, I'd run into someone I know pretty much. And they knew what I did, and they would say, oh, I haven't seen you ref. You still ref? You've been injured? So, no, I've been ref. I just, you know, did you not see me referee this game the other week? And I'd be thinking back, goodness me, that was a month ago. But then you'd have, were you this weekend? Oh, I'm fourth official at so-and-so. And that, after a while, does wear you down. It becomes very difficult to keep telling this kind of, oh, yeah, everything's fine. Well, it's not really. You know, if you're honest with yourself, you're not fine. You're just being resilient. You're just kind of digging in for a bit. And also on the field, of course, we have this need to show strength and not show weakness. And then that becomes, after the game, you still want to defend your decisions, probably rather too long and rather too deep, but that's in our nature to try and defend what we've just done, because that's kind of human nature, I think, to some extent. This resilience becomes so, your skin gets so thick that it starts bleeding into everything else that you do. And this need to be strong. So when I'm walking down the street and people ask me those questions, I'm going to be, no, I'm fine. And you're always presenting that way. I would imagine you would have been through similar phases in your career where this resilience becomes part of your personality now, to the point where you actually aren't honest with yourself, that you're actually struggling here, and then you might need a bit of extra support. And I'm sure I went through that. I'm sure I did.
I had the same thing at Aston Villa for a while. You know, how come you're not playing? The weeks roll on and you're seeing, bumping into people. Are you out of the team? Why are you not playing? This type of thing. And after a while, you know, you become a little bit embarrassed that you're not playing. Mm. Because I always wanted to play and I found it unbearable when I wasn't playing. There was nothing worse than being sub. Hated it. You know, obviously you want the team to win and do well because it's good for everybody, but there was nothing worse than training all week to then go into the match day and sitting on the bench for the full 90 minutes. There was nothing worse.
I saw you shaking your head there, Luke, for the entire answer, really, Graham. What the schedule after a match, do you think you had less feedback as a player?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you're talking about 3 or 4 days now after the game that you've reffed and you still can't move on to look at what you might be doing for the weekend. You know, very quickly in football, it's on to the next training session, putting things right as quickly as you can, and then focusing on who you're playing next. But this seems a little bit unbearable, yeah, if I'm honest.
Well, there's this overlap. So on a Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock, you get your appointment for the weekend. So you're starting to think, project forwards, but you're still having to process what's gone the week before. And actually the outcome from the KMI panel comes very late in the week. So, and then you get sent clips on a Friday to review from the previous week from other games that have been of interest. So talking points or contentious decisions or complicated decisions or decisions that have divided opinion, whatever. And that can get in the way as well.
I'm going to say, do you need that? Is that a little bit of a hindrance
to
you?
I think you need the information, but you could do with it rather earlier. Mm. It does feel to me that by the end of Monday or even Tuesday, you should be able to put last week to bed.
There is a huge psychological impact here. I'm just wondering, I don't know if anyone's asked you this before, is there a service there for referees where you can talk to somebody? Because we always ask that of players. Is there a psychologist in the team? What about you guys?
There is. It's been reviewed recently. I think the feedback from the referees is that what we had wasn't quite working for us. And again, it's all set up with professionally with the best of intentions. My feeling was it would be better to have someone who's entirely external from the organisation who you knew you could really go to and get that support. Now that is available through we have private medical insurance as professional officials, and we can go and get that. I guess I chose not to. I got other sources of help through mainly through a close friend and family and so on. And what they're trying to work out at the moment is the different types of psychological support we need. So some of it is around literally on the field, the psychological support we need and how we cope with situations and conflict and pressure, stress, being surrounded, whatever. And then there's the stuff away from football, which we talked about a bit earlier, around your resilience and your ability to cope with the demands of being in the goldfish bowl that is the Premier League. And they probably need two, I think they can probably, I suspect, I don't know, I'm not involved anymore, but they'll settle on a kind of a dual surface that provide, hopefully addresses both of those areas.
Did the pressure ever feel too much, and how did you persevere through it?
It never felt too much on the field. I always felt in control on the field. As I said earlier, you have got the power in your hand, or in your pocket, to deal with any situation if you want to. You have a choice. If you choose not to send a player off who deserves to be sent off, you've brought that on yourself. You know, you could have done. It's the stuff away from the field which I found tougher. I mentioned earlier about a season I had that didn't start well. On the opening weekend, there was a very long pass upfield. I was still coming over the halfway line when there's a tackle in the penalty area. And from where I am, it's the 10th minute. I can't give a penalty. It would have been a penalty and a red card in the laws of the game at the time. I couldn't be sure enough. I really couldn't. It wouldn't have been a guess, but it would have been an element of deduction. And it was just a bit, I couldn't be sure. So I didn't give it. Well, that comes back as two mistakes, because you should have given a penalty and you should have sent him off, all being one decision. But so that really knocked me back on the opening day. So you start off basically bottom of the list. And then at the end of the first month of the season, I did a game where an assistant told me an offence had been inside the area and was actually outside. And it came back, I thought, well, surely that's on him, really. I mean, but the feedback was, well, no, you should be good enough at this level to overrule him. You know, yes, he's telling you that, but so that was another one. So I'm literally bottom of the list after a month.
Sounds pretty harsh.
Yeah, but it is tough. So you're bottom of the list after a month, having ended the previous season thinking, this is my year to push. This is my year to push to try and get to the Premier League. At that time, while you still can, you can see where you are on the list. You had to log in and go to some effort. You didn't get phoned or text message that you couldn't avoid. You had to go and find out. I just stopped looking. I stopped looking for the rest of that season. I didn't look. I'm not going to look. I'm just going to concentrate on my games. And eventually I kind of clawed it back and ended up finishing about halfway up. That was really, 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 really difficult. You know, you kind of feel as if I haven't done much wrong here, and yet this is where I've ended up. Because the other consequence of that, if you're bottom of the list, is when the appointments are done, they start with the people at the top. So the big game on the TV or first v second, better go to someone who's doing well. And then you're left with 15th v 19th in League Two, and it's not what you were hoping for. And you've got to go and deliver that game. Now, I always did. I took every single game I did, I treated exactly the same way. It didn't matter. My preparation was the same. My mindset was the same. But obviously, you've got to get up for that. You've got to put yourself in that position before kickoff. That's where you really need support for the people around you.
If you'd have got two games where there was hardly any sort of difficult decisions for you to make, you could have found yourself way up that table and be getting, you could, depending, I mean, on what game you get.
Yeah, the way the marking scheme certainly worked then, to a degree it always will, is if nothing really happens, you just get a middling nothing mark. At pre-GMO, I've been trying to take the numbers out, because if I got to the end of this podcast and I said to you, right, okay, well, I thought you did well there. I thought there were some good questions. And I think you're doing a really good job. But there were a couple of questions that maybe weren't as clear as they could have been. So I'm going to give you a mark now of 74.621. You'd look at me like I'd gone a bit mad. I mean, you don't go to work and get a number like that at the end of your week and go, oh, is that what I did? But that's how it works.
Is it subjective? So it used to work. Could you almost think, well, I don't think that was fair?
Yeah,
often.
Whenever it was low, you thought it wasn't fair. When it was high, you thought, yeah, I did do well. Yeah, because that's how it works. That's how our minds work. But then the challenge is, okay, if you don't give people a number and create a league table, how do you decide who the best ref is, who gets the best games? You have to have some system.
Apart from Luke, who was the most difficult player to referee? someone who always tested you on the field. By the way, you didn't cross over, did you?
No, we didn't.
Somehow,
yeah. I would have been on the line and then reffing just as you were still playing. But
you brought your card. You could book him today if you want.
I'll pass. Oh, he's done anything wrong. He stayed on his feet. That's not true, is it? One of the toughest games I did involve a high-profile player who had a reputation for being difficult, which was Joey Barton. Funnily enough, it was at Burnley. So I did an FA Cup fifth round game between Burnley when they were in the Premier League and Lincoln City when they were in the National League. And Lincoln won the game 1-0. And they had this big lad up front, and he was big in every sense. He was tall, but he was also stocky. And this player who played for Lincoln was a master at winding up the opposition. And Barton just couldn't take it. You know, he was being wound up. And there's this incident, which is, I think it's probably available somewhere on YouTube, where I it was in my peripheral vision, so I couldn't be sure enough to do something about it, where he pretends he's been trodden on and then goes down holding his face when the other player's not touched him. That day, he was almost impossible. He just wouldn't cooperate with anything.
What did you do in that moment then?
I suspected what had happened, so I assured the Lincoln player that I knew that he'd done nothing wrong. And then I spoke to Barton and just looked, you know, it's at some other point in that game, he got a yellow card anyway. He had it in him, should we say, to be difficult.
Do you think that the respect from players towards referees is getting better and they're more respectful towards the ref? Because in my day, some players, and probably myself guilty of it as well, would really, you know, lay into a ref, run up to them, get in their face, and you'd get away with it. You wouldn't get booked and stuff like that.
I think it has got a bit better. The FA do what they can, are generally quite good. So we report far more than people realise. We report when that happens. So if we get surrounded by two or more players, generally we will caution, but in the moment you might not be quite aware of what's going on, because as I said earlier, you're focused on listening to your assistant maybe, or you're looking through the players at something else. You know, there might be two players on the ground and you're checking whether someone's injured and you don't really notice you've got all these people around you. It does genuinely happen. There are times we turn a blind eye to things that we shouldn't. But we do report those, and the FA do investigate, and they probably start with a warning, and then they'll move up through fines. Eventually you can lose points, but no one's ever got anywhere near that. But generally, I found players were quite respectful. I looked them in the eye and I told them what I was giving and I told them why. And if they didn't like that, well, that was on them. But generally that was accepted. Sometimes it matters so much to them in that moment that they're not processing what you're saying anyway. And I get that.
And do you think we'll ever get to a stage where there's a level of respect that the rugby referees have?
I think if you ask rugby referees, they'd say it's not as clean cut as it looks. And that I was speaking to some yesterday and they say, no, the level of dissent in rugby since it's gone professional has gone up. Quite unquestionably. The interesting rule change that's just come in the Irish sports, in the Gaelic sports, is that if there's dissent, the ball is moved 50 yards up the field. So in rugby, it's 10 metres. And it seems to have almost completely stamped it out, because 50 is always worth having, isn't it? Whereas 10 yards in football, you might say, well, that's not going to make any difference. I'm going to tell the ref what I think. Yeah. There was usually an enforcer stroke troublemaker who would test you early. They'd gob off, or they'd come at you, or they'd come and tell you what they thought, or they would, you know, they'd stick, they're the one who's going to stick a tackle in often as well. If you dealt with that positively and publicly, the other players in the team, then, a bit like you were saying earlier, okay, if he's going to be like that, we'll back off and we'll just play.
And some managers would often say, you know, get in the ref's ear hole, because you can influence at times. If you're constantly saying you've made a mistake there, ref, you've got that one wrong again, that's three in a row now, ref.
Yeah.
You can kind of start building a little bit of pressure onto the ref. And I always like I said to Graham earlier, the ref that communicated why he'd give something and didn't even nearly look like you could influence them, great, okay, let's just get on with the game, because you're not going to influence them either way.
If you could pick one match from your career to relive purely from the experience of being there, because I've heard you talk about officials want the Premier League just like the players do, because it is the biggest stage, right?
Well, the first Premier League game, I guess we've covered that really. The game I enjoyed the most in the moment was probably, I did a League Cup semi-final between Bristol City and Manchester City. So in the previous round, in the quarter-final, I'd been fourth official when they beat Manchester United, which was an extraordinary event. When the semi-final draw came round, they were drawn away at Manchester City Manchester City in the first leg, obviously home in the second. And everyone just thought, well, they're going to get battered at the Etihad. You know, they've had their day. That tends to happen, isn't it, in cup runs. You've had your shock win. Now this is when you're going to get taught a footballing lesson. Well, they turn up and they did a really good job on them, and they lost 1-0 to a very late goal. And I got the second leg. So now there's something on this. You know, Bristol City thinking, we've beaten United. We've given them one good game. We'll go again. And again, it was one of those nights where And there's something about playing under floodlights. I don't know whether you enjoyed it more or not, but I certainly, as a ref, there was something about under lights that made it feel more of an occasion. And Full House, Ashton Gate. It was one of those games where it was felt a privilege to be on the field, surrounded by all these players. De Bruyne, the City Park, good side. De Bruyne was the best player I reffed. I thought he was sensational. You standing 5 yards away from him, he's seeing passes before anyone else. He's, his body shape means that as soon as he receives the ball, he's just pinging it first time with either foot. It just a joy to be next to and to watch from such close quarters. So he was playing. He ended up scoring, but. And it was close all the way through. City did lead, and they had a two-goal advantage, but Bristol City kept coming back, and then they brought it back to 2-2 on the night in the last minute. So we're right down to the wire where if they could score again, we'd be going to extra time. They didn't, and as it happened, Manchester City got the ball, broke and scored, and that was the end of the game. But it was just occasionally you have those moments where you think, just lucky, how lucky am I to be right in the middle of this?
I just find it amazing that you go through all of that and you can't show any emotion.
No.
You can't show any.
No, absolutely not.
It sounds like you enjoyed that game, almost like in a state of flow, if you like. Yeah, being able to enjoy the quality that was on show as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's a clip, if you go onto any social media platform, do a clip, there's a clip of Frank Worthington long before our time where he scores this absolutely wonderful goal for Bolton in the 70s. And the ref claps him. It's hilarious. You see him in the foreground just going, wow, that's amazing.
Like, that's what you felt like watching De Bruyne.
Yeah. You're like, wow. And occasionally I would say that to a player if they scored a great goal. Or I'd tease them and go, oh, so he's offside? Surely not.
You can't be.
Oh, yeah.
Who did you do that to?
Oh, I can't remember.
You've got to be careful with stuff like that.
Well, some
players don't like it.
Yeah. But you try and make sure you choose your moment. Yeah. Don't you?
Imagine you're worldie again for Middlesbrough and Graham comes over. Sorry, it's offside.
Or if they found a little foul about, 10 seconds before it on the VAR, I'd have just done about 3 laps celebrating.
I wanted to ask you, actually, is there a rule that you'd like to change or implement?
Lots. The handball on the goal line, the deliberate handball on the goal line, not talking about what he's hit his arm and argue the toss. So Suarez in the World Cup for Uruguay.
Yeah, when he dives to save it.
Dives to save it. When it's 1-0. It's a penalty and a red card, so he misses the quarterfinal, I'm pretty sure. He misses the semi-final. But it's now a penalty, which they miss. Well, if the ball's going in, we've got the footage now to prove the ball was going in, just give a goal. Why are we giving a penalty and sending a player off? Because there's actually an incentive in the last minute to save it. Because if the ball's going in, the keeper might save the pen, or he might blaze it over and hit the bar or something. I can't remember. He totally didn't score. So that's one. And then the other part of that is when a player's clean through on goal and is taken out, thinking 1980 Cup final, are you old enough to remember this? No. Willie Young and Paul Allen.
Look at him, he's a young man.
Yeah, I know. I chose the wrong moment then. But there are other examples of players clean through on goal. Again, 1-0 on the last minute, you'd take the red card and a free kick outside the box, wouldn't you? If it's clear that it's a denial of an obvious goal scoring opportunity, why does it matter that it's outside the area? It still should be a penalty because you're giving back to that team what they would have had, which is a very good chance of scoring.
Well, when you think about the Suarez one, you do feel like that should be given as a goal, but it'd be unprecedented, wouldn't it, to start giving stuff that, it's almost like a penalty try.
Yeah.
And then the other one, I don't think you can give a penalty if it's not in the box because then you are completely changing the rules.
It would be a big change. I accept that. But at the moment, we give a penalty for a shove in the back in the corner of the area when they're not even looking like scoring. It's just a bit of clumsy defending. They now get a free shot at goal.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm a defender and I'm running back and I know I'm not going to stop his shot and it's the last minute and I'm winning, I'm going to take him out and probably take the red. If I'm going to pick up 3 points, 3 points are massive. And
yeah. So I always think the best laws in any sport penalise the whole team in a way that you don't commit the offence. That would be where my starting point would be. I think it's a strange ethical situation sometimes we get to in football where a player is praised, commended for taking one for the team and deliberately fouling. Would you say that to a 10-year-old? Yeah, this is what we do in football. We deliberately foul people because it suits our team in this moment. I'd like to think we don't, but I wouldn't put it past some coaches. But I feel that I'm uncomfortable with that. I love the sport, and I want the better team to win. You become a ref because I did because I wanted to see fair play, and it doesn't sit right with me that that it's somehow in your interest to foul.
Is there anything that would make your job easier, though? Because I don't think that second one does, did it? That's like another decision that
possibly
could be
there
either
is
or.
Yeah, that is an argument to be had around that, I agree. And often when people suggest things, I think, oh, it's all right for you, you'd have to enforce it.
Exactly, yeah.
People say they want us to get the decisions right. Well, just leave us alone, and we probably will most of the time. The more you bombard us with feedback and try to get in our heads and scramble our brains, actually the more likely you are to make mistakes. So just trust us to do our jobs. But I get why players are, you say 3 points are massive. It's potentially the difference between winning a league, staying up, whatever, or if it's a cup game going through.
Yeah.
I do get that.
I think
I played, I understand.
Sometimes players look at refs as someone in the way of them perhaps winning the game at the weekend. They could be the difference. One bad decision can ruin everyone's week, and
yeah,
that's why there's...
Although you don't remember the ones where you win because of a decision, which will happen. So
yeah,
you get given
sure.
a penalty that's not... And you win 1-0. Well,
I was going to ask you that. Do you get much praise, or is it generally very, very negative? Like, this, you could have done this better. This was a mistake. Is there a lot of praise or not at all?
Not a
really?
Lot, but we understand that actually when we describe a game afterwards to other people, if we say it went fine, there was nothing that happened, we talk about 22 handshakes. If everyone is basically saying afterwards, thanks, ref, that's brilliant. If the managers come on and say, thanks, ref, that's brilliant. You don't need them to say, I thought you were really, really good. I thought you were brilliant. You know, they're not going to, they're unlikely to say that. Mm. Once in a blue moon, they might. I do remember doing a game, a non-league game at Enfield. It was Enfield against Enfield Town. So a proper ding-dong derby. It was a Phoenix club that had been created because Enfield had gone bust at one point, or were going bust. And this, I can't remember which team won, but the losing club secretary came in. I thought, oh, well, here we go. He's going to say me. And he just said, I just wanted to say, I thought you were absolutely outstanding. You really helped enhance that game. And he was like, oh. It took me completely
What do I do
price.
With this praise?
You lost. You're not supposed to be saying that. You know, so it's the fact that I can remember, that was about 20 years ago. I can remember it.
Yeah. I think again, as a player or fans and anyone that's going to be negative towards a ref, you do forget that there's a human behind there, and you just think, oh, it's the ref, you can, and they're fair game, if that makes sense. A bit like players, I think fans feel like it's fair game to say whatever they want to the players, and refs probably even more so.
Yeah, I think the fair game thing is a good way of putting it, and we're not, we are people underneath them. We accept we're going to get some feedback, we're going to get criticised, and we're not going to get chaired off if we have a good game. We get that, and we don't want to be either, by the way, but... Nonetheless, there is a human being in that kit who's got to cope with that.
Luke, when you came in today, did you have an opinion on referees generally, and has it changed after this conversation?
When I played, I never remember taking much interest in who the ref was that day. I didn't particularly know all the refs' names, and I never thought, oh, great, it's him today, or oh, no, it's that ref that I don't like. I never really paid any attention. And I think that's the reason why, is because I knew any ref could have a good day and any ref could make a human error and perhaps cost us points. So I was never overly friendly with any refs, and I never really had any favourites or disliked anyone any more than the rest, if that makes sense. But I think when a ref comes away and you don't notice that he was out there, I think that's good all round for the game, because also there were some refs that quite like to be the main character, and I think they're the ones I probably, if any, would have disliked the most, because you're supposed to be like almost not recognised and seen and just ref this game the best of your ability. Some of them did, you know, want to be the main character at times and like have a bit more of an ego about them.
Yeah, I think that's much less the case now. I don't know how much it was then, by the way, but certainly the current crop of Premier League refs really just want to disappear after the game and no one noticed they've been there. There are some who use their coping mechanism to pressure.
I was just about to say that.
I'm going to be very...
The NFL officials, they are well-built guys.
Stacked.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that more of a common theme these days as well?
The refs are certainly fitter and stronger.
Yeah.
I mean, the training programs we get, we've shown them to play, and they're kind of very impressed. I mean, do you all this in the week? Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're extremely fit. extremely fit.
You still look really well now. You could probably still ref now.
There's a compliment for you. There's an MPO compliment.
He's not used to that, is he? He doesn't know how to take it.
I mean, I agree entirely. Yeah. I mean, my hips and back will tell you otherwise.
Yeah.
That which is largely a function of age, but also a function of doing the job for so long, and then sitting in a car. You come off the pitch within half an ace, within an hour you probably leave the stadium, but then you get back to the hotel, you get in your car, and you might be sitting in your car for 3 hours, and then you can't walk for 2 days. You get to the point where it's just can't get down the stairs and things like that.
Been there, post-marathon. A couple of questions for you to finish off. The funniest or strangest thing you've heard a manager shout at you from the touchline?
Well, very early in my career, I did a game at Bicester Town, I'm not sure they're still going, but in the Hellenic League. And the manager was banned from the bench because he'd been sent off previously. So he's now standing in the terrace behind, in the other side of the pitch. Can't stop someone going in to watch the game. And quite late in the second half, I didn't give a decision. I made a decision not to stop the game. And he suddenly shouted, "Oi, oi. Ski instructor, what are you doing?" I was like, "What's this about?" And I did have a bit more hair then, maybe a bit kind of a kind of 90s kind of quiff, I don't know. But to be called a ski instructor, that definitely was the new one on me. I'd never been skiing. I said to him, he came on the pitch at the end. I said, "I've never been skiing in my life. Where'd you get that from?" That was the weirdest one, probably.
Quite nice, though, if you compare it to today's.
Well, it didn't involve any swearing.
In your opinion, what would football look like without a referee?
Well, it couldn't exist. So football started without a ref. The two captains would agree between them whether or not it was a foul. Well, that didn't last very long, did it? I mean, that's not going to work. And so initially they appointed someone to whom they would refer, hence the term referee, they would refer decisions on which they disagreed. Well, before long, that just becomes this person's going to make all the decisions. So the game doesn't exist without the refs. But I would emphasise, I said, covered this a bit earlier, the importance of good refereeing to the game. They enhance games, they enhance the spectacle, they enhance the entertainment, while at the same time trying to enforce the laws. And that is a difficult balance to strike. But the Premier League refs are genuinely the best at it, and it's not appreciated by football. Go on, if you really think you want the consistency and this robotic approach, watch La Liga, watch Serie A, and tell me you prefer it, and you won't, because that's why everyone watches the Premier League. It's because of the way the game is reffed.
And do you think that it could possibly be even more leaner with the fouls that are given? Could more be let go, or is there a bit of safety involved in that after?
There's
that?
A bit of safe refereeing around, so I tried to describe earlier, around sometimes a safe defensive free kick. For the goal challenge on the keeper tends to be overprotected, don't they? When I played in goal, I can't pretend that otherwise. One thing I noticed at different stages of my career, especially latter stages with more experience, is quite how much you could let go and people would accept it. As long as you did that all the time, you didn't suddenly start giving really...
I'd prefer to watch a game if it was let go a little bit more than it is. But then you've got to be consistent all the way through.
And you're trying to be consistent all through the game. Games ebb and flow, though, don't they? Mm. So once if you have a situation where it's 6-0, are you really going to start being, do you really need to start being heavy-handed on the team that's being battered? You might just be a little bit more relaxed. But it's always very much in the margins. You don't suddenly referee completely differently. Mm. The context of each decision is important. And that could be related to the score, to the time. It could be, all sorts of factors at play. But it shouldn't make a big difference, but it might tip you one way or the other when you've got a call that's maybe 50-50, 60-40.
Yeah, and in your experience, is it better to let something go if you're not sure rather than give it?
Yeah, so absolutely. So people can be forgiving if you miss something. They might wonder how, but any person could, their eyes might land on the wrong point, or they might get blocked off by a player or whatever it may be. What they won't forgive you is you saying, "This player has just handled the ball when it's hit them in the face." They go, "Well, how can you send a player off for handling the ball or give them a yellow card for handling the ball when it hasn't even hit the hand?" If you're not sure, give nothing, move on. Obviously, with the VAR safety net, you can now accept that there will be someone who will check you haven't made a really calamitous mistake.
I was given a penalty against myself for Middlesbrough away at Aston Villa I think it was Ashley Young, actually, for Villa. He takes a shot and I throw everything at it. I turn my back for the ball not to hit me in the face. And it kind of hits the back of my shoulder, stroke top of my arm. And for me, it was never a penalty in a million years, but it got given. But I was thinking, surely that ref's got to be certain that my arm is in an unnatural position and that it's hit my arm, and it was really harsh.
The first thing is you've absolutely got to be certain it's hit your arm. I mean, that's just fact. Whether it's an offence, of course, you've got multiple layers of that, whether it's how far the ball's travelled, how quickly it's come at you, what were you trying to do? Was your arm in a natural position? Were you making yourself unjustifiably bigger? So many factors, and you might fulfil three of them and not the other three.
Yeah.
And in which case, is it a penalty or not? And also, that will depend on opinion.
Did you feel different the debut in the Premier League compared to the other games?
I tried consciously not to. I was more apprehensive. My heart was beating quicker. Mm. But I was standing in the tunnel and Burnley were out first. Villa were kind of on their way. And Tom Heaton just looked me in the eye. I always looked players in the eye. I thought it was a really important part of the way I refereed people. And Tom Heaton looked me in the eye and he just kind of went, good luck. He knew, they all knew. But that was such a nice thing for someone to do. And it really helped, in its small way, just helped me feel, that even these guys are kind of hoping, well, wishing me well, obviously for their own advantage. But I'm not sure. I don't think he was doing it in the hope I would be kind to him on pitch. It was just a nice thing, human thing to do.
Yeah. And was there a part of you going into that game thinking, this is what the whole journey's been about, to get to this level?
Yeah,
this is what I always wanted to do, and this is finally.
I've likened it to getting your first England cap as a player. You know what that's like when you put that shirt on. And I remember putting that shirt. I mean, I'd worn the Premier League shirt as fourth official, but you know, it's like if you know you're going to be an unused sub, is it quite the same? But knowing you're going to be leading the teams out, picking the ball off the plinth, blowing the whistle to start the game. I started the game too early.
was it 2:58?
well, it was 2:59 and something.
Okay.
I kind of knew about this protocol, but in this kind of heady. Kind of, this is all happening to me. I'm kind of giddy with excitement. I wasn't giddy, but you know what I mean. I was kind of, really keen to get the game started. I've got two teams lined up. I've got the ball on the centre spot. My assistants are ready. Fourth official's ready. Okay. And I'm going, right, okay, let's go. The fourth official then comes in and says, do not start the game. Do not start the game.
Off we went. So you've been marked down before you've even started on this one. No wonder you was bottom of the league.
So it was. Oh, sorry. Oh, was I not supposed to do that? It's too late now. I've started. I started a local game off once too early and the team scored straight away. And then so the other team kicked off the start to restart the game. And it was the only goal in the game. And these spectators came up. I went into the bar. This is the kind of level where you're going to the bar after the game. They went to me in the bar again and said, oh, you ref, I've got a thing about you. I'm not happy about you. I said, well, you kicked off too early. We missed the only goal. And not only that, they were supporting the team that won 1-0. We spent the entire, there was no scoreboard, the entire match wondering why we weren't pressing, we're not even trying to win. What's going on?
Oh, it's 0-0.
They thought I'd watch the 0-0 draw. And only when they got in the bar and they're chatting, did we? We won. We won. So of course they then weren't very happy with me. Kicked off early.
Who'd be a referee? I hope people listening and watching have a better idea of it now. I'm conscious of time. You've been absolutely brilliant. I did want to ask you, which sport do you think has the best officiating system? And in 10 years' time, is football officiating talked about less or more?
One of the things about, I was at an event yesterday where officials from all sports were there and the governing bodies. And actually, everyone seems to have similar challenges around participant behaviour, spectator behaviour. All the official groups seem to say they're in the same sort of position. It is seductive looking what happens in rugby because there does seem to be a level of respect and there are laws that really help the refs. But at the same time, increasingly now on my kind of social media feeds, there's criticisms of rugby union refs and teams protesting and, claiming the suggesting somehow the kind of underlying suggestion there may be conspiracies or teams are unfairly suffering. So there is a theme actually that runs through all sports where there's always something, there's always a decision to be made and it's always there's always going to be something that's contentious. I don't know whether, I was thinking last night about darts and whether, how do you referee a darts game other than just having to be able to count and duck? But I bet there's been times when the ref has been the centre of attention, even in that. But maybe I could go with darts as the one where all they want to do is count. It looks easy.
The thing is with referees, the questions just keep coming, don't they? Is there one thing that fans just wouldn't know about either the game itself or your job?
I think probably the biggest omission at the moment in people's knowledge of the game is how VAR really works and what it's like to be in that role. I'm the first person to come out of doing that job to do this kind of thing, try and explain it. And it's, I'm trying my best to, you know, to get the message out there how challenging the role is, but without, at the same time, not looking for sympathy, but trying, you know, maybe a bit more understanding of quite how, what the challenges are and what you've, you know, we were talking earlier about the number of cameras. People say if you can't tell in 30 seconds, it can't be clear and obvious. You got 30 cameras. Which one of those is going to give you the best angle? Which one are we going to go with? You don't know until you start. You employ someone to try and find you the best one, and they're good at that, but they'll sometimes not find you. There might be the fifth, sixth, eighth they look at is the one that tells you actually fills in the gap. And then you have a situation like I was describing earlier where you've got three, four, five incidents in one check, goal check. That there isn't always a lot of understanding for that. And how challenging that can be because each one is different. Do you use slow motion? Do you use close up? Do you use something from further back? And football's the only sport that doesn't use the broadcaster. So other sports use the rugby or the cricket. They'll go, right, to the TV director, show me what you've got. And the TV directors have got loads of resources, loads of experience. We're relying on a replay operator. Possibly, if it's a really big game, they put two or even three on to try and help. But those people are trying and they're the hardest to get you the best angles. And the TV companies, they can show the replays next time the ball goes out of play. It could be 2 minutes later. They've had plenty of time now to line up all the best views. And we're trying to do it in real time while the game's going on sometimes. So that understanding of how VAR actually works and the challenges of it and that it will, the idea that it's going to solve all the game's problems is clearly nonsensical. It will improve outcomes. We have more accuracy. Good. I think you would say it's definitely worth the accuracy, but there's a big price to pay because of the time it takes out of the game, the fan experience in the stadium in particular. And we will still have decisions. There's about 4% of the key decisions in a season last year. 4% were still considered to be wrong. And then you've probably got the same again, possibly more, that some people would say, well, that isn't even on the list. That was clearly wrong. And you'll say it was clearly wrong. And you'll say, well, I'm not so sure, you know. So,
yeah, in the argument whether we should have VAR or we shouldn't, I watched an early, it might have been an FA Cup game where there was no VAR. And there was two decisions. I think one was given as a penalty and probably shouldn't have been. And there was clearly an offside goal. Now, when you're watching a game that doesn't have VAR now, there's a lot of mistakes that would have been corrected by VAR. So it's almost like you can't watch a game now thinking that it's not going to be better to have VAR. Yeah. So I don't know what we would do without it now. Even though there are these decisions that can still go wrong, it's still better to get it right the majority of the time. And in this instance, the game I was watching, two clear mistakes for both goals that would have been cleared up by VAR.
Yeah. So on VAR, the two areas where I think the biggest gain, quick gains could be made are on offside. So if the assistant can know instantly that through the AI technology they've now got that a player is offside, they can flag it straight away on the field rather than waiting for a goal to go in or delaying the flag, which annoys everyone, doesn't it? It's what the clubs say they want, delay the flag just in case you've got it wrong. But then everyone plays on and then like a minute later, up goes the flag and everyone goes, why didn't you just put it up earlier? So that would clearly help. And then it's around just speeding up the process. And not speeding up the process so much as involving the fans in the stadium. So going, as I was saying earlier, can we show it up in this big screen? Can we take people on the journey with us? Can we let them listen to the audio, listen to the reasoning? Yes, I can see there is some contact, but I don't think it justifies that theatrical fall. I'm therefore going to award a drop ball or whatever it may be. Because those delays in the game don't really affect you when you're watching at home because you're seeing replays, you're seeing other things, but they big time affect the stadium and they affect the players. So the players could now see it. And of course they will all argue the toss, but we need some protocols around that to make sure they don't get in the referee's face while he's trying to check the screen, but I still think it would be better.
So when you hear the name Graham Scott, what goes through your mind? What do you think? We ask every guest this.
Oh, goodness me. I'd like to think that people don't recognise me as a ref. I didn't even know you're a ref, because you don't notice the best ones, right? That's what I'd like to think. I'd like to think that people would recognise I speak honestly, openly, I'll answer your questions, and I've got integrity. But whether that's actually true, of course, is very much for others to judge.
Thank you so much for your time. And because of all these reviews that you've been part of the process for so long, if you could head to Apple Podcasts, Graham, and Spotify, give us a review. I don't know if there'll be 5 stars. You're a tough critic, right? Please do. For those listening, get on that as well. Sign up for our YouTube channel as well, More Than a Name Podcast. Subscribe. Get in touch with us, morethananamepod@gmail.com. And social media, Luke's all over TikTok now, More Than a Name Pod. Graham Scott, thank you so much. We've learned a lot about refereeing. I wouldn't want to do it. What about you? We'll see you next time.